Welcome to the nationally syndicated In the Oil Patch radio show with Kim Bilotto, broadcasting from the Port of Corpus Christi studios. Get more on the Port of Corpus Christi at portofcc.com. In the Oil Patch radio show will give you an inside look at the oil, gas, and energy industry and how it affects you from industry experts and government officials right here on the In the Oil Patch radio show.
Welcome to In the Oil Patch Radio. I'm Robert Rapier, Editor-in-Chief of Shale Magazine, sitting in this week for Kim Bilotto. This week's guest is Dr. Britt Bennett, the Policy Director for Life Powered, an initiative of the Texas Public Policy Foundation to raise America's energy IQ. Welcome to the show, Britt.
Thank you, Robert. Great to be here.
So in this first segment, I always like to start out by having you tell listeners a little bit about yourself and about the mission of Life Powered, about, you know, kind of what you're up to. Then we can dive into some of the important energy policy issues. So tell us a little bit about yourself and why you're passionate about energy issues.
Yeah, so I grew up in Midland, Texas, kind of the heart of the oil and gas business. My dad's an oil and gas entrepreneur, so I've had energy in my blood since the day I was born. And always been an energy guy. But I studied batteries as a battery engineer in graduate school and coming out of graduate school, really fascinated with that technology, really enjoyed working on it. But have since, you know, because of life circumstances, made my way into energy policy. And just in general, I've enjoyed the ability to, with this job over the past 6 years that I've been with Life Powered, to get up every day and study energy. That's what I really like to do. That's what I'm passionate about. So whether it's energy in the policy area where we're at now, or energy in the industry, or, you know, building energy products, that's what drives me. And I think that it's what drives a lot of your listeners too. And so we realize how important energy is to our lives. And we're like, man, I want to make energy more affordable, accessible for everybody else. That's what gets us up in the morning, right?
Right. So, yeah, you and I share a lot in common. We both are passionate about energy. We both went to graduate school in Texas. You went to UT. I went to A&M. And importantly, we both share a goal of raising America's energy IQ. That's something I'm very passionate about. I probably spend more time debunking misinformation about energy than any other topic. So let's talk about some of the major misconceptions around energy. What are some that you run into often that you see people are really misinformed about energy?
I think the biggest misconception is that people don't understand the difference between different energy sources, right? The pluses and minuses of different forms of energy. All we see is the electricity that, you know, comes through the wall right here. you don't see where it's coming from. The gas in your car, you know, you don't see where it's coming from, right? So you pay a bill and you get energy. And that's the beauty of our energy system, is that it's so invisible to most people. It works, right? That's what's made modern life possible. So I think the biggest misconception is that somehow the transition from one energy source to another, or the ability to use one energy source in different facets of our lives, is somehow very simple. Right, that there's not a lot of complex physics involved. So this idea that the energy transition is not only underway but somehow inevitable, I think, is the biggest myth, and it derives from the fact that people don't understand where energy comes from. Right, so at Life Powered, a lot of what we do is educating policymakers and the public about where energy comes from. It's just that simple. I mean, it's that simple and that hard, right? Because politicians, the reason I have a job is because politicians and most people, you know, don't have any training in science, right? You have training in business or communications, or a lot of politicians are attorneys, right? So they're experts in law and human behavior. And we all have experience with the education system, with healthcare, right? You see these things, you see doctors where you go through the education system, you have some experience that. We don't experience energy in the same way. It's invisible. And so that leads to the second biggest misconception I think that we have, which is that somehow we can transform our energy system just through incentives, right? The stick of subsidies and the stick of regulations and the carrot of subsidies, right? and that you can move numbers around on a spreadsheet to get us to use different forms of energy without considering physics, the physics of where energy comes from and how it's transported and used. And there's a lot of things about that that no amount of subsidies can change, that it takes technology and long development periods to change how we use energy.
For the listeners, define energy transition. I mean, what, so everybody's on the same page, what are we talking about when we talk about energy transition? What does the Biden administration mean when they say energy transition?
Yeah. The idea comes from the fact that we have, over time, transitioned from using primarily biofuels, wood, and animal power and human power, to using fossil fuels to power our lives, right? So you look over the past, 200 years, and that's the energy transition that has happened to make the modern world possible. And so the idea is that we can then achieve that again by moving from fossil fuels to moving to renewable fuels, wind, solar, and water, right? So that's what everybody means when you say energy transition. And the idea is that somehow, because the fuel is free, right, and you have, look outside me here, there's a lot of wind and a lot of sun right behind me here in Oregon, Not a lot of sun in Oregon most of the time, but there's a lot of wind all the time, right? So everywhere has sun and wind, right? And that you can harness that and access it, and that somehow we can make that cheaper and more easily used than fossil fuels, which are not as evenly distributed across the globe and not as, existing finite amounts, right? So that's the idea behind this sense that we have some, the inevitable evolution of the energy system is towards renewable fuels and away from fossil fuels, right?
So I think a lot of people, if you ask the Biden administration, how's the energy transition going? I think they'd say, well, we're well on our way. I think you'd disagree with that. If 100% renewables for our energy is a complete energy transition, how far along the way are we really?
Yeah. And that's really the biggest myth, that somehow when you are even at the start of the energy transition. To finish what I was saying in the last sentence, the thing about renewable fuels is that you still need non-renewable materials to harness the energy, and especially to transport it, and then to have it ready to use in a form and at a time that is appropriate, right? So energy is not just a thing out here. It's really, it's a service that we're providing to people. And that service has to be timed and managed according to customer demand. So what's so great about fossil fuels and all hydrocarbons is that they're very flexible. They can be used for a lot of different things. They can be transported easily and available on demand, which is very hard to do with wind and solar, which can only produce electricity and only do so at certain times. So you need energy storage, you need other means to transform that electricity to heat, to everything else that we use, the motive power for our automobiles, right? So it's very hard to convert that energy. And so what we're seeing happening in the energy transition is, the supposed energy transition, I should say, is that we're seeing wind and solar displace a very little amount of electricity production. In Texas, we're at about a third, and we're the most of any state. Overall across the country, it's about 10% of our electricity production. A little more than 10% is from wind and solar now. But electricity production is only a third, not even quite a third, of the total energy that we use, right? The rest goes to transportation, to industrial uses. And we haven't seen hardly anything, any input there. So you add it up, and wind and solar are about 5% of our total energy right now. And that 5% has only displaced a couple percent of fossil fuel consumption. And so the other three is extra energy that we're consuming, right? So we're consuming almost as many fossil fuels as we did 15 years ago.
Right.
So to say that, so there's a bit of, I would call it, we've had a bit of an energy expansion, right? We're consuming a little more, and that extra is being done with wind and solar, and that's about it. The rest is not transition. And that's the easy 5%, with the electricity production that wind and solar are designed for, right? That's not the industrial heat and the transportations that require extra transformations of that energy to make it useful.
Right. I tell people, you know, we're less than 10% along this energy transition. And I think that is a big misconception that we're, you know, well on our way. But, you know, fossil fuels still supply more than 80% of our energy. And, you know, I think we're spoiled to that. There's never been a time in my life that I couldn't go down to the service station and get power, get electric, get energy, get fuel for my vehicle. And you know, no country in the world has managed an energy transition. You know, I was in Iceland a few years ago, and a lot of people have the impression that Iceland is running on renewable power, and there were fossil fuel vehicles everywhere. You know, that no country in the world has managed an energy transition, and I think there's a good reason for it. You know, fossil fuels are energy dense and convenient and cheap, you know, not non-subsidized. And we'll get into that in a little bit, because I think one misconception is that fossil fuels are heavily subsidized versus renewables. And we can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's looking at the countries like Iceland or Norway that get almost all their electricity from renewable sources, geothermal for Iceland, hydropower for Norway, is a good summary of what might be achieved with wind, solar, and even if you include nuclear, because nuclear primarily just produces electricity, right? You still have in Norway, they are spending heavily on electric vehicles. 60% of, over 50% of new vehicles sold in Norway now are electric vehicles.
Let's put a pin in that, because I want to dive into that a little bit, but we need to take a quick commercial break. But Norway and EVs, I've written a lot about that and talked a lot about that. Mm-hmm. I want to dive into that a bit, because I think people are under the impression we can go the way of Norway. So let's take a quick commercial break, and we will jump into that topic right after the break.
The Texas Oil and Gas Association Safety Group is your pipeline to discounts, dividends, and industry expertise. It's a value-added benefit from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, the state's leading workers' comp provider. At Texas Mutual, they know the oil and gas industry, which means you'll have access to expert resources and information that make your business better. As a Safety Group member, you'll also save about 12% on your workers' comp premium, and that's just the beginning. While Texas Mutual policyholders can earn an annual dividend for keeping their workers safe, Safety Group members can get something even better, a second dividend. That's up to 2 dividends every year. Plus, you'll get service-focused coverage from Texas Mutual, a workers' comp partner you know and trust. The Texas Oil and Gas Association Safety Group is tailor-made for your business. Talk to your agent or learn more at texasmutual.com/TXOGA. Dividends are based on performance and not guaranteed.
Welcome back to In the Oil Patch Radio. I'm Robert Rapier with this week's guest, Brent Bennett. Brent, before the break, we were talking about Iceland and Norway, and you know they're heavily moving to decarbonize their electric sector. So how has that experiment gone? You know, I've been to Iceland, I've been in Norway, I've seen, you know, what's actually on the roads over there. And I would say that their oil demand hasn't changed a lot. So tell me about these experiments from your perspective.
Yeah, you're right. They're as I was just saying, about to say before the break, you know, Norway's oil demand has barely been dented by the proliferation of electric vehicles there. And the reason is that most of the people who have EVs have it as a second car. They use it for commuting, which is great. EVs are useful for that, you know, day trips where you can charge overnight. But you still have, you know, cargo transportation. You still have, you know, people who commute long distances or live in rural areas that drive a majority, especially in a country like that where there's a lot of public transportation. That drives the majority of their gasoline demand. And so what you've seen in Norway is even though they're selling a ton of EVs because they subsidize them to death, not to death, but they subsidize them into life, I should say, that still is barely denting their oil demand. And so I think that's sobering for us when we see, you know, the Biden administration trying to roll out, you know, very stringent new fuel economy standards and greenhouse gas standards with the purpose of making, you know, 60-something percent of all new cars sold in 2032 EVs. Norway's already there, and they're still barely denting their gas demand because all the EVs being sold are essentially extras, you know? They're not really the primary workforce vehicles that are doing all the work there. That's a good example. My next-door neighbor has a Tesla and loves it. He uses it to commute to work. But when he needs to haul his kids around, he's got a big GMC Denali, you know, because he's got three little kids, right? They go on road trips. That's a lot. They still consume a lot of gas, even though they have a Tesla. So I think that's representative of a lot of people that will eventually buy EVs. So that's, you know, that's the challenge with EVs. They're still a niche product. And as great as they are in some ways, there's a lot of things that you can't do.
Right. And I think your point there that it's generally used as a second vehicle is lost on a lot of people. And you know, it explains why Norway's oil demand, their gasoline demand is down some, but their oil demand is not much changed from where it was 10 or 15 years ago. And, you know, I've written about this and I've written about California. You know, California is the leading edge of EV, the EV market in the U.S., and their oil demand hasn't changed a lot. You know, they're still, and ironically, you know, they're the heaviest dependence on the Middle East is California. So despite the fact that, you know, EV sales there are robust and they've got lots of good incentives, you know, they're still heavily dependent on you know, gasoline to get around.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And if we really wanted to put a near-term dent in gasoline demand, it would be much more worthwhile to invest in hybrids, because hybrids people would use hybrids as their first vehicle. I'll probably get a hybrid for my next vehicle when it comes time, because they've gotten a lot better and they're not, as the cost of batteries has come down and the size of the battery needed for a hybrid is a little smaller now. It's hybrid batteries are 50 to 100 times smaller than EV batteries, right? And you can get a big bump in fuel economy. So you imagine, you know, if we were to just take all the EV subsidies that we have right now and apply them to hybrids, that would make a lot bigger change in oil demand. Just getting rid of all the inefficient cars that we're driving on the roads now, getting people to buy newer, more fuel-efficient vehicles would make a lot bigger difference in gasoline demand than trying to get people to buy EVs that they don't use that often or use for just short trips. So that's the backwardness of the policy. It's all directed around, it's not even directed towards emissions, if that's what we were wanting to do. It seems to be directed around an ideology about, you know, favorite fuel sources and favorite, you know, vehicles, right? And getting people to buy those things rather than thinking about what do people actually want to buy and what are people using it for and what would actually reduce emissions, you know?
Right. I think the intentions are good, and I think there's always unintended consequences, and people often don't understand, you know, the consequences of what they're asking for. And I agree with you. We ought to be incentivizing different things than trying to force everyone into an electric vehicle, which I just don't think is going to work out very well.
Yeah, it makes you wonder at what point are the intentions good when we see so much evidence of what's the right thing to do if you wanted to actually reduce emissions. We're starting to learn more over time. And yet, and the insanity is trying to do the same thing over and over again or doing more of it. And what we see in the Biden administration is more stringent, fuel economy standards than what the Obama administration tried to do. More subsidies to the Inflation Reduction Act. We've already learned that this stuff doesn't work. And it doesn't really have much of an impact on fossil fuel demand, because all the subsidies do is encourage us to use a little more than solar and not actually displace the fossil fuels, because physics says that we have to use the fossil fuels to get what we want out of our energy. The on-demand energy and heat and products and all the things that we use it for. So that's I think the insanity of it is that we've seen over the last 20 years what works and what doesn't work, and we're still trying to do more of the same thing. And that to me makes me wonder, like, are people, is this being done on purpose just to try and force us to, use different things rather than, is it really about the emissions? You know, if it was really about the emissions, then I would think people would start to sit up and notice these things. And I hope that's the case. I hope that more people do that. and recognize that, you know, it's about the emissions, not the fuels.
Right.
You know?
All right, so let's take a quick break right there and continue after the break. I'm Robert Rapier with In the Oil Patch Radio.
Are you a business owner feeling overwhelmed where to begin your business's online presence? Maybe you've spent thousands of dollars in the past just to be highly disappointed with the results. We understand because we were once you. Since then, we decided to hire the very best experts to help us and you.
Let us send you our business profile that will quickly show you your Google business rankings in these five areas:
reputation, ratings online, website, advertising and social media, and search engine optimization. All of these areas really affect how Google ranks your entire listing.
So if ranking on page one is your goal, pick up the phone and call us now, 210-240-7188, or simply go to shalemag.com/business profile. We'll be in contact with you within 24 hours. Once again, pick up the phone and call us now, 210-240-7188, or simply go to shalemag.com. That's shalemag.com/business profile. Start dealing with a company you can trust and always find.
Welcome back to In the Oil Patch Radio. I'm Robert Rapier with this week's guest, Brent Bennett. So, Brent, in the previous segment, you mentioned AV subsidies. Let's dive into energy subsidies in general. EV subsidies, fossil fuel subsidies, renewable subsidies. I think the general, I run into this misconception all the time that people literally think the government is writing checks to ExxonMobil, and that's why ExxonMobil makes so much money, because we're subsidizing them. And I have to explain again and again the nature of these sorts of energy subsidies. So can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Most subsidies take the form of what we call tax expenditures. So whether it's the production or investment tax credit for wind and solar, whether we talk about intangible drilling credits for oil and gas, that's most of what it is. And you can go back and forth about the amount. I mean, with the Inflation Reduction Act, now wind and solar are going to be getting a lot more. Historically, it's been a little more balanced. You've seen oil, gas, coal, and nuclear get roughly the same amount over the last decade as wind and solar. But the difference is that, you know, again, the oil and gas, the fossil fuel and nuclear industries are way bigger than wind and solar. So when you look at it on as a function of the amount of subsidies per unit of energy produced, wind and solar get a whole lot more, tens of times more, and dozens of times more than fossil fuels, because they don't produce nearly, like, we're a lot smaller industries. So they're a lot more reliant on the subsidies than oil and gas. And furthermore, wind and solar are only used to produce electricity, right? Now, like I said, that's about a third of our energy consumption is from electricity. There's oil and gas are used across the entire spectrum, everything. And so if you look at it in that way, the distorting effect of subsidies on electricity markets is really severe, because only less than 20% of oil and gas subsidies flow into the fuel, which is gas that's used to make electricity. The rest goes into everything else in oil and gas form. So if you look at the impact on the electricity market, it's even more severe, right? And that's why we're only building wind and solar right now in our market, in most of the markets across the country, because that really just heavily unbalanced effect, right? So even if you were to concede that they receive similar amounts of subsidies, which again is not going to be true going forward because of the Inflation Reduction Act, even if you concede that, it's still, when you look at just the electricity market and the effects of what the subsidies are doing and how they're harming electricity markets, that's a really important subject that I think people need to get their heads around. And we've got to do something about that. We've got to restore balance to those markets, or else our grid's going to collapse.
Right. The funny thing is, I see people screaming about subsidies. I see there are organizations devoted to highlighting, you know, what they say, trillions of dollars of oil subsidies around the world. And, you know, I sometimes will pin people down and say, you know, what does that mean? What do you think that means? That is primarily consumer subsidies. And if you want to hear You want to hear somebody like Bernie Sanders scream bloody murder, threaten to get rid of some of those consumer energy subsidies. They're classified as oil subsidies. And yet, you know, when they've tried to eliminate the low-income heating assistance program, you know, Markey and Sanders and you know, people on the left are screaming, no, you can't do that. But that is an oil subsidy. That is categorized as an oil subsidy. So
yeah,
you've got people saying, on the one hand, we've got to get rid of oil subsidies, and you pin them down and you find out, well, no, not that subsidy. So I've said before, everybody is in favor of energy subsidies, everybody. And everybody's in favor of oil subsidies. It just depends on, you know, what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's right. It's, and again, I think it comes down to, you know, do we want, the question of subsidies is first of all, they work to stimulate production a little bit, but they don't change the underlying physics of energy systems, right? Physics is what determines what's useful for us. And technology and markets are what drive, you know, energy production, consumption, right?
Right.
Subsidies can only affect that at the margins. And so we're going to be wasting a lot of money, Inflation Reduction Act, I mean, in the trillions, if we don't, you know, limit it in some way.
Let's
I mean, it's not going to move the needle very much, you know?
Right.
It's not going to move the needle.
Let's dive into that a bit after the break. Let's talk about the Inflation Reduction Act and what it's supposed to do and what you think the effect will be. So let's take a quick break there, and we'll be right back after the break.
Attention small and medium-sized business owners. Are you feeling overwhelmed with back-office tasks like payroll, workers' compensation, federal regulations, safety laws, employment standards, and benefits? Don't worry, Unique HR has your back. For over 30 years, our team of qualified professionals has been providing people-centered solutions to help businesses like yours navigate the heavy burden of running a business and managing their workforce. We're the PEO with a pulse, and we are just a phone call away. Call us today at 361-852-6392. Unique HR, the partner you can trust.
Welcome back to In the Oil Patch Radio. I'm Robert Repier with this week's guest, Brent Bennett. Brent, before the break, you mentioned the Inflation Reduction Act. And I've actually written before that this is not an inflation bill. It was actually a climate bill. Yeah. I mean, you know, most of the provisions in there are aimed at climate issues. But can you tell us a little bit about what is the Inflation Reduction Act? What will it accomplish?
Yeah, so the largest parts of the Inflation Reduction Act are really just an expansion of subsidy programs that have been in existence or have been talked about for a while. So you talk about the production investment tax credits for wind and solar. It essentially makes those permanent because it sets them, it sets the credits to a, basically, instead of setting a sunset time of 10 years or something like that, it actually sets them to a bar where until we get to a certain amount of greenhouse gas reductions, the tax credits will remain in place. So again, that's what you say, it's a climate bill. We're actually set, the provisions of the bill are setting the tax credits to a standard of, we have to get a certain amount of emissions reductions. The problem is, as I just explained, is that that's probably never going to happen. There's only so much of our emissions reductions that you can displace with wind and solar, right? Now one of the big enabling technologies is energy storage, which is my old field. And there's a big addition and expansion of tax credits for energy storage. That's going to be a big one too. I mean, these are, we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars for energy storage projects. The challenge is that, you know, energy storage is expensive, and the technology development is slow. The things that make it exciting as an engineer, you know, it's difficult, make it tough to sell as a product because you're trying to compete with the cheapest form of energy storage we've ever discovered, which is fossil fuels. And trying to store electricity in a battery is a lot harder than digging up, you know, fossil fuels that nature's already created. So those things, you put all that together, and we're going to be spending trillions of dollars. And I don't think we're going to see the emissions reductions that the proponents hope for because of physics. It's just that simple. And
I think if we really wanted to make a difference, then we would be spending a lot of that money on nuclear, because that, you know, nuclear can actually, you know, displace a lot of fossil fuel electricity production in a way that wind and solar can't quite do now. And it's much more scalable, right? And much more energy dense. So it doesn't use as many materials. It doesn't have as big an impact on the land. There's a lot of environmental benefits there that I think are not going to be realized. You know, we're essentially trading with the Inflation Reduction Act. We're trading, you know, air pollution emissions for land pollution, which is, you know, having to spread our energy production system across a wide swath of land instead of, you know, using, you know, smaller amounts of land that we use for fossil fuels, right?
This falls right in your wheelhouse. I mean, what do you do to educate the public about misconceptions around nuclear and skepticism around nuclear power? What are you doing? What can you do to help, you know, us? I mean, because we just aren't pushing nuclear power in the U.S.
Right. And it's not because the technology is not there. Again, the reason energy storage hasn't taken off is because of the technology. It's a hard technology. Well, nuclear is there. We have scalable nuclear technology, but, you know, we stifled it with regulation. And I think, you know, even today, although I think, you know, attitudes are changing the further we get from the Cold War, that nuclear is still a 50-50 issue. People are still about 50-50 for and against. And you're not going to see a lot of big change until that starts to change. And so you see polling showing that nuclear is an 80-20 issue, or 80% people want more, you know, then you start to see momentum for change. But it's going to take some time, I think. It's going to take time to change the regulations to bring more sense to that. And then it takes time to build, too, because even though nuclear is very scalable, it's still, you know, power plants take a long time to build. And so it's just going to take time to bring that back. I think eventually we will, because physics just dictates it. When it comes to electricity production, there's no better for electricity. There's nothing better than nuclear.
Right.
It makes all sense. Now if you want to transform that into electricity for vehicles, electricity for industrial heat, there's other steps that make it more challenging. But when it just comes to just electricity production, it's a world beater. So I think that eventually will win out. And I think eventually, you know, because people are going to demand it. People are going to want, you know, emissions-free, cheap electricity. They don't want emissions-free, expensive electricity that we get from wind and solar, you know?
Right. I think one of the misconceptions people have is where emissions come from and what's driving emissions. And if you look at the last 50 years, the primary driver of emissions is coal in Southeast Asia and increasing coal consumption there. And they have rapidly increased their carbon emissions, where U.S. emissions have gone down over the last 15 years, and they've been pretty flat. Even if we go back 50 years, our emissions are relatively flat. So I think the lowest hanging fruit out there is to push nuclear out, not just in the U.S., but even more importantly, to China and to India, is to get them to shut down those coal-fired power plants and switch over to nuclear power. I think that would have the most dramatic impact and the best, you know, the best most cost-effective way to reduce carbon emissions that there is out there.
Yeah, and what you see, again, this goes back to scale, is, you know, that is where nuclear is being built around the world, is in developing countries, particularly China. They're building more than anybody else.
Right.
But it goes to show how insatiable energy demand is, that they're doing that at the same time as building the most coal plants of anyone in the world.
Right.
Because from their perspective, they need all of it.
Right.
And they're just looking for, okay, what's the, you know, if we need so much energy, it's hard to get it all from one source. So we're going to get everything that we can. India's in the same boat. Right. If we can ever liberate sub-Saharan Africa from, you know, the shackles of their politics and economics, but you would see immense energy demand growth there, and they would be doing the same thing. So I think that's the lesson there, is that, you know, we're not going to accept energy scarcity. And so, yes, we need a vast expansion of nuclear, but even then, we're still going to see people consuming fossil fuels because it's just, it's hard to get as much energy as we need all from one source, you know? And I think the same is going to be true for the U.S. for a long time to come too.
All right, so let's take a quick break right there, and we'll come up on our final segment with Brent Bennett on In the Oil Patch Radio.
Are you a business owner feeling overwhelmed where to begin your business's online presence? Maybe you've spent thousands of dollars in the past just to be highly disappointed with the results. We understand because we were once you. Since then, we decided to hire the very best experts to help us and you.
Let us send you our business profile that will quickly show you your Google business rankings in these five areas:
reputation, ratings online, website, advertising and social media, and search engine optimization. All of these areas really affect how Google ranks your entire listing.
So if ranking on page one is your goal, pick up the phone and call us now, 210-240-7188, or simply go to shalemag.com/business profile. We'll be in contact with you within 24 hours. Once again, pick up the phone and call us now, 210-240-7188, or simply go to shalemag.com. That's shalemag.com/business profile. Start dealing with a company you can trust and always find.
Welcome back to In the Oil Patch Radio. I'm Robert Rapier with this week's guest, Brent Bennett. Brent, in addition to the other things you do, you're a senior fellow for the National Center for Energy Analytics, NCEA. Can you tell me a little bit about your role there and what you're doing for them?
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. So I think it's a really exciting new development. You know, Life Power has always had a national mission, again, raising barriers of energy IQ. But, you know, we found over time that needs to take different forms, right? And it helps to have different groups doing different things. So what we've done in the past year is our former director, Jason Isaac, has gone out and launched a new energy trade association called the American Energy Association. It encompasses all forms of American energy. It's not tied to a specific energy sector, which is one of the problems that we've seen is that we get tribal in our energy, in the energy world, right? You know, you're an oil and gas guy, or you're a nuclear guy, or you're a coal or a wind guy, or whatever, you know. Jason's gone out and created a new trade association for that and try and improve that side of it. We brought in Mark Mills, who's one of the, you know, leading voices on energy, to found and be the director of the NCEA, which is essentially going to be an aggregator of all the different energy experts and voices, and to be a better source for spreading that information, which is something we've been trying to do at Life Power for a long time. But we think that, you know, with Mark and the new center, we can really scale that to new proportions to fight the, we're saying, you know, we're energy expansionists. We're trying to fight the energy reductionists that are out there and saying, you know, we need to consume less energy. We have to contract. We need to have a message for flourishing. And not only do we need a good message, I think we have a good message. We need messengers. We need a lot more messengers. People like you and me out there doing this stuff. So that's kind of the purpose of the NCEA, is not only to expand the message, but also to bring on a lot of new messengers, people that are out there that are doing good work that, you know, need to have a bigger platform for their voice. So I think that's not just in the politics, but also in with the public. So they just published their first Wall Street Journal editorial yesterday. We just launched the initiative officially last week, so it's hitting ground running, and I'm really excited about what's coming with that. And as a senior fellow, I'll just be, you know, one of those voices trying to help, you know, add to the conversation.
Do they assign you topics to work on, or you just do whatever you think, you know, needs attention?
Yeah, Mark kind of is prioritizing what needs to be done from a, you know, standpoint of, okay, here's all the things we could do, prioritize them. The senior fellows, we kind of pick her up among that, right? Say, okay, I can do this, I can do that. We'll have a paper on EV infrastructure coming out pretty soon. I've got previous work I've done on electric vehicle subsidies, right? How much we're subsidizing EVs. So trying to do more of that and giving more ammunition to people to go out and, again, you know, be a messenger, be a voice for energy realism and insanity. So that's, we hope that NCEA will be, again, both the provider of information, but also a forum for people who want to be messengers and bring that to the world.
And Mark and I ended up sitting next to each other in a conference, 6 or 7 years ago. And I didn't know him before then. And we got to talking and I thought, yeah, this guy gets it. And he said, you know, we should work together on some stuff. And we really were aligned on a lot of things, but I don't think I've talked to him again since then, but I definitely have seen a lot of his stuff. Cause it, you know, a lot of times when I'm researching something, there'll be him talking or, you know, something that is very much in line with my thinking. You know, a lot of the stuff that he writes and talks about is stuff that I'm passionate about.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you should hit him up and try to be a contributor at some point. So I'm sure he can use your voice and your talents. Right. And that's the idea. I think that's what we all need to do. Those of us who are promoting, you know, sound energy policy, it's not just a whole government install, it's a whole industry that's trying to basically assault realism and just energy reality in the name of kind of a myopic focus on particularly carbon emissions. And I think that's the problem, is that we don't have a holistic view these days because energy, going back to what I said in the beginning, our energy system is so invisible and works so well that we don't have a deep understanding of just how complex, how easily it can be disruptive in trying to pursue myopically emissions reductions or anything else in the name of in forgetting about energy affordability, reliability, and flexibility, all the things that we take for granted about energy. We can't do that. We can achieve emission reductions, but we have to do it in a way that's measured and that uses appropriate cost-benefit analysis. It cannot be that zero. There's no cost-benefit to that zero. It just says we have to go to zero or the world ends. That's not true. There's a cost-benefit continuum to emissions reductions. We need to operate along that. And so I hope that we can bring that message to the world. That's what inspired me to get into this field, is to bring that kind of sensible thought to this, and hopefully more people can do that. I appreciate the fact that you're doing it here. We need hundreds, thousands of more forums where people are doing that to counter the kind of insanity that's going on.
Right. I think realism is the operative word there. And I say that sometimes. I tell people, you know, there's the world that I would like to live in and the world I actually do live in. And yeah. I write and talk about the world that I do live in. And people say, don't you want to get off fossil fuel? And I say, I would love to be able to have energy that doesn't pollute. I'd love that. That's not reality, and it's not going to be reality for a long time. So we've only got about a minute left, but tell me, you know, what reality looks like. What does America's energy future look like from here?
I think it's encouraging that despite everything that the federal government is doing to restrict energy production, that we're producing more energy than we ever have. And that's a function of technology and people pursuing more energy in markets. It's just this beautiful thing. And if we can unleash more of that, then we'll have more freedom and eventually cleaner energy. I think that, you know, because we'll have the wealth. That's what we've done, is we've used the wealth created by energy to create emissions control technologies that reduce our emissions. And if we impoverish ourselves trying to pursue emissions reductions, then we won't have the wealth to actually do what we need to do to secure ourselves against the climate, to run our air conditioners, right? To do all these things. So to me, it's about liberating American entrepreneurship and markets to develop the technologies and the systems that we need to, you know, make us flourish in the future. And I think we can do that. I'm still optimistic. We have been doing it for 100 plus years, and we can continue to do it if we allow that to happen. So I'm hopeful we can do that. I hope that the insanity of the last decade or so is something that we can turn around and start to point towards a brighter future.
Well, Brent, that was a great conversation. I really appreciate you joining us. Maybe look forward to having you again sometime, and I will look forward to following your work.
Thank you, Robert. Yeah, I look forward to seeing what you're doing too and working more together in the future.
You bet. And that was this week's guest, Dr. Brent Bennett, the Policy Director for Life Powered, an initiative of the Texas Public Policy Foundation to raise America's energy IQ. That's this week's show. I'm Robert Rapier. We'll see you next week.
In the Oil Patch is where, together, we explore topics that affect us all in oil, gas, business, and in your community. Every week, your host, Kim Bellotto, will visit with the movers and shakers in this fast-paced industry. You'll hear from industry experts, elected officials, and many more right here on In the Oil Patch. We'll